Welcome to the Everyday Innovator Podcast for product managers, developers, and innovators. Your host is Chad McAllister, who gives you innovation training your customers will love you for. Get ready to take your career to the next level, for the doctor is in.
Hi, everyone. My guest today is the person who executives turn to for advice. He has worked with more than 100 of the 1,000 largest companies in the world and has been founder or CEO of 5 companies. And as an example of his experience, he provided innovation consulting that led a well-known consumer goods company to add $200 million revenue in year one of acting on his advice. His name is Nathan Rosenberg, and he is the co-author of a chapter in PDMA's Design and Design Thinking book titled Leading for a Corporate Culture of Design Thinking. Nathan, thank you for discussing design thinking with me and the everyday innovators who are listening.
Chad, happy to be here, and thanks to you for inviting me to do this with you.
Absolutely, and thanks for the contribution of PDMA's book. Design thinking is a topic that a lot of people are interested in and want to know more about. And I'm curious, what led up to you and your co-authors writing about the corporate culture aspects of design thinking?
Well, Marie-Caroline Chauvet, who's one of my partners, is on the board of the PDMA, and heard that the book was going to be published, or at least I guess it was at the idea stage still then, and, mm-hmm. and thought we might be able to make a contribution. And so we submitted a proposal, and lo and behold, we were one of the lucky ones to be selected to write a chapter. And so Marie-Caroline, who is in our Paris office, and John Kleiman, who's on our East Coast office, and I put the chapter together, and it was really a great collaboration.
Very good. And for listeners who may not know, PDMA had a series for several years called the Toolbook series, Toolbook 1, 2, and 3, which I'm familiar with because I also had contributed a chapter to one of those. And now they're doing the Essentials series, and I believe this is book 2 in the Essentials series. I think the first one was on open innovation, and now this one is focused on design thinking. And it's a great time to be writing that book because a lot of us are really interested in those topics. Let's talk about that importance of culture. It's been getting lots of attention, you know, in recent years. And, you know, every now and then you come across some article titled something like, you know, culture eats strategy for breakfast or lunch or dinner, you know, kind of pick your favorite meal there. Can you create a foundation for our discussion by defining corporate culture and why that's important?
Culture at its simplest level would be whatever's reinforced within the organization. Mm-hmm. A more complex but accurate definition would be the unwritten rules for success within the organization, obviously still at the level of behavior, but it's, you know, how do I know I'm doing well? How do I Right. know that I'm succeeding? How do I know that I'm doing the right things? And the answer is because the culture tells you that you're doing the right things. And maybe more importantly, it certainly tells you when you're doing the wrong things.
Right. So sometimes it comes back and bites you on the back.
Right. As we say, you know, mostly how you, when you're new to a company, how you encounter the culture is you bump into it. Right. It's like you, I don't know if you've ever had this experience. I have it every once in a while. I try to walk through a glass door that I didn't see, and it's shocking. And I think for a new employee in a company, when they violate the culture, it's that experience that I just walked into something I didn't see.
Right, exactly. Now, unfortunately, in my case, during my college days, and I swear I was not under the influence of education I've been, I ran through that glass door and did it bounce off. But
I understand.
Thankfully, just a few scratches and then lots of broken glass. So I do like that perspective of the unwritten rules. And I've always kind of thought of culture in terms of, you know, it says how we do work here. And like you said, how we also don't do work here.
Yes. Okay. Exactly.
So in your chapter, you write about 4 pillars for enabling design thinking. And now listen real quick. They're the leadership mandate, dedicated infrastructure, proprietary process, and supportive culture. I'd like to talk through each one of those with you. Is the first one, the leadership mandate, a good place to start?
Yep. These were invented by my colleagues, Doug Bate, And Bob Johnston. Bob, by the way, was both president and chairman of PDMA. In fact, he's who introduced me to PDMA. And most of what I know about innovation, I learned from Bob and Doug. So the four pillars are their creation. And I think it's no mistake that pillar number one is leadership mandate. It's critical that executive management make clear that the success of the company is based in innovation. It's got to be written into the strategy. It's got to be public. In a publicly traded company, you got to talk to your analysts about it. You got to talk to your board about it. And a privately owned company, it's got to be clear to the board as well as executive management that innovation is critical. And then the second piece of it is that design thinking is going to get embedded in the way we work around here. I remember a couple years ago, Randall Stevenson, the CEO of AT&T, and I are on the board of the Boy Scouts of America together. Randall will be our next president. And during the break, we were talking, and he said, "Well, Nate, what are you up to?" And I said, "You know, I just went to Stanford Design School, at D School, as they call it, and participated in a design thinking boot camp." And he said, "Well, what's design thinking?" And I said, "Randall, I think it's the next source of competitive advantage for companies." And he said, "Wow, I've never heard about it." And I gave him, Roger Martin's book on design thinking and an article that I'd written for our Insignium Quarterly magazine, and it's so antithetical, Chad. Design thinking is so antithetical to the normal engineering-driven, linear-driven ways that all of us have been educated to think and work at the executive level. So I think a new way of thinking, a new way of approaching things can be a source of competitive advantage. And as we say in the book, you know, A.G. Lafley at Procter & Gamble was the guy to recognize this. And you'd have to say that he created a mandate for it. And then you'd also, I think, most analysts would agree that a big part of the success that P&G has had in the last decade is a product of that mandate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think a lot of people that have been involved in product management recognize that when it comes to anything in regard to innovation in an organization, it really does start at the top, right? Yep. Anything else we do tends to fizzle out if it isn't really supported at the top. So I appreciate that leadership mandate being the place to start with and making sure leadership is behind what is being done. And in this case, behind a design thinking sort of approach.
Yep.
Okay. So our next pillar for enabling design thinking in an organization is dedicated infrastructure. What kind of infrastructure is needed?
Well, you know, there's this journey, again, as Bob and Doug, my colleagues, Bob Johnston and Doug Bates say, there's this journey that everybody takes from recognizing, hey, we need some innovation around here, and innovation being an ad hoc thing that when we need a little extra revenue, when we need to improve our processes, when we need to get a new product or a new service, okay, let's innovate. To then it becomes more part of, yeah, you know, innovation's kind of central to our business and it's part of the DNA of how we want to operate. So let's have R&D run innovation to the third stage where innovation is across the board. It's not just R&D that's innovating, it's everybody in the company. Mm-hmm. And to get to that third stage, you probably for sure, you need resources for innovation. You know, we have a debate in our firm, and I'll just be open kimono with you about this, Chad, of is it appropriate to have a chief innovation officer? Is it appropriate to have an innovation department or an innovation function? And I think Right. we land on the side of you probably need an innovation function, whether you need a chief innovation officer or not. My argument is the CEO is the chief innovation officer. Like I think the CEO is the chief quality officer and the chief customer officer, but you know, I'll leave that to the academics to argue that piece, but there's got to be resources. There has to be processes. There has to be structures that are widely known in the company for, I have an idea for innovation. How do I move it forward?
Right.
Who do I go to? Do I know that there is money in the budget that I can call on to spend on this, at least to get to my first prototype? Who do I take the idea to? All that needs to be built in. So when we talk about infrastructure, probably there's an office of innovation. Probably there's a significant budget in that office that can be, and the money can be moved relatively easy into innovation ideas to take them into innovation projects. And certainly there are people who are trained in innovation, and there are people who can train other people in innovation. And then there's people who can coach people who want to innovate. So those would, I would say, are key. And then the one that Chad, I think that we've come up with that I think is fairly different is you have to have a scoreboard. One of the things that's wrong with big corporations is the way bookkeeping's done. And we understand why bookkeeping is done in a particular way, why accounting's done in a particular way, so that when you look at a financial statement, it's not different from another company's financial statement as to structure and rules. Mm-hmm. But what gets lost in standard accounting principles is, what's the return on the money invested in innovation? Wayne Delker, who was the head of R&D and then became the chief innovation officer at Clorox, Wayne invented metrics for measuring what he called return on innovation. And just like there's metrics on return on capital utilized or invested capital, Wayne had a measure to show the contribution of new products and new services to Clorox's bottom line. And I believe you must have a scoreboard as part of this infrastructure, in addition to the other, let's call them more obvious aspects of the dedicated innovation design thinking infrastructure. Does that make sense the way I laid that out?
Yeah, with the focus on the scoreboard, the metrics really help you evaluate if you're being productive or not with your innovation efforts.
There you go.
Are there details of that in the book, or maybe references that you point to?
Yes, there are, as okay. a matter of fact. And by the way, we actually lay out a five-step process that a company could take, the executives of a company could take, to make that journey from ad hoc innovation to innovation structured into the corporation.
Okay, very good. Yeah, and I know if we went down the path of talking about metrics, that could be the rest of our time together. And I want to make sure we uncover
exactly right.
uncover everything else, the key points. But I did want to ask that question so people know that they can go to your chapter and get more details on that. Because metrics are also a hot topic, and you know, choosing the wrong metrics leads to complete the behaviors that you do not want. And so choosing metrics
that's exactly
are
right.
really important. And I also like the flexibility that you described in the infrastructure, you know, whether a chief innovation officer is needed. You know, the point is that if we simply say innovation is everyone's job, then it often ends up being no one's job.
You're right.
The point here is have the infrastructure in place to really facilitate making it everyone's job.
That's it. Right. Okay. Exactly right.
Very cool. Your third pillar is a proprietary process. And this one actually made me curious because, you know, design thinking, like you mentioned, you went to D school. Arguably, design thinking has been IDEO's approach, but that they've written about a lot. And so there's nothing, you know, proprietary about that. What's the processes you're suggesting that are proprietary?
Yeah. It's really the invention process, the creation process that a company has from taking a an idea. And you know, in the context you and I are talking, obviously we're talking about products, Chad, but innovation, once it gets into the corporate culture, innovation is everywhere. Innovation is in finance. Innovation is in human resources. Innovation is in how the executive, the C-suite manages itself. So when we talk about a creative process that's proprietary to the company, it's really how do we, A, get ideas, B, how do we take those ideas and get them to a prototype, then how do we take the prototype and turn it into either an investment or stranded innovation, something we're not going to invest in right now. How does the investment take the idea and then turn it into a first stage product or a new process or a new structure? And then finally, how does it get implemented? So I think, you know, at the school, they teach you that the five-step process. And as Bernie Roth says in his new book, you know, there's different words that different people use for those structures, whether you use empathize, which is the word that I love for the beginning, or if you use observation and interview as the first word, you know, probably that's where you're going to begin. But you need some meat on those bones, frankly, especially, again, big corporations. I cannot tell you how many people that I have consulted with, and we consult with people, literally everybody from the CEO to the people on the factory floor. And I cannot tell you how many people on the factory floor, people at entry-level jobs who have great ideas and they have no idea how to move that idea forward or even to whom to speak. And that's part of this process. Right. And that process has to be a fit. Innovation has to be a fit for the company, and the company has to be a fit for innovations. That's why it's proprietary.
Right.
What works, you know, let's take three fast moving consumer goods companies. What works at Procter & Gamble, what works at Clorox, and what works at SC Johnson & Son are, I am willing to bet a lot of money, are going to be three different processes. Why? Because they have three distinct corporate cultures.
Right. Absolutely.
Does that make sense?
It does. And
yeah, great question, by the way. Great question.
Thank you. The need here really is to align with the culture that you have.
That's
right. And it's a subtlety that I think a lot of people can over just not see, and indeed focus on the strategy and the processes. And because I'm sure there's some people that were listening as you went through that list, you know, the five stages and that you learned at D school and show up in other places for developing a product, that you know, this is just a phase gate sort of approach, and you know, we might have an agile version of it and different things like that.
Yeah.
But the magic sauce that really comes that creates differentiation for companies is how they align that process specifically with their culture.
Yep.
Right.
And Chad, you know, I mean, one of the points that we make all the way through the chapter is you apply design thinking to design thinking. So innovating your own innovation process is important. Creating your own innovation process is important. Why? Because your relationship when it's my process, when it's our process, is different than when it's your relationship with it is their process that we're applying to our company.
Right.
Those pronouns are important.
Right. And that's what separates companies, right?
There you go.
We can all buy the same technology. We can all try the same strategies. But culture is this very specific thing to organizations that develops over time.
You got it.
And as you said, it's how we get things done. And some companies do things very differently. Which does lead us to your final pillar, which is on a supportive culture.
Yep.
So we've talked about culture a bit throughout this. But specifically, what culture is needed to support the use of design thinking?
Yes. So, you know, two companies we talk about in the chapter, one is Southwest Airlines and another one is Amazon. And I think just as a marker, one of the things that's special about both of those companies is their emphasis on the customer. You know, the stories of Jeff Bezos when he's in a meeting, there's an empty chair, and the empty chair's for not for Elijah, but it's an empty chair for the customer. And I think it's important that that's an aspect of a culture that really supports innovation. That's an aspect of a culture that supports design thinking is the more in touch, the more touch, taste, feel, smell that the people in an organization have for their customer, the more that corporate culture is going to be supportive of design thinking. Mm-hmm. To the degree that a company is playing inside baseball and that the corporate culture reinforces please the executives, the less that culture is going to support innovation and design thinking.
Right. And I guess this ties back to the leadership mandate too of what is it we reinforce?
Yeah.
And I'll share a quick example with you, Nathan. I was an organization where our little team was working really hard to go after this big customer. And it was a proposal. We knew what work we'd be doing, resulting in, tens of millions of dollars of work, which for our company was a big deal. And we worked really hard on this for several weeks and ended up not being the winning team. Right?
Yes.
So what could senior leadership do at that point? They called us all together in a room, and the person that led the whole effort was there too. And none of us knew what was going to happen. We were all a bit nervous about this, actually. And the person that led the effort received a reward for all the hard work. We all got a lot of recognition that day because they knew that we worked really hard on this. We didn't win. But even by not winning, that was a really important cultural step to take for the company, right? To reinforce that it's worth taking those risks to try to do something new.
Yeah. And, and obviously, one of the big learnings for me, and none of your listeners will be surprised by this, but for me, it was a shock. You know, one of the big learnings for me at design school, at the D school at Stanford was, the purpose of prototyping is to find out what's wrong with your idea, not to validate your idea. And that was like either a slap on the face or a cold shower. But built into design thinking is you're going to fail over and over and over again until either you decide to kill the idea or you by luck or by work get it right. And I think that most corporate cultures, big company corporate cultures, don't allow for the experience that you had. The people in a big company would have been sitting in that room wondering, are we going to get our pink slips out of this? And so to recognize effort, to recognize that people tried something new, and then more importantly, maybe, Chad, is to have a process, again, going back to this proprietary process, to debrief the process. Mm-hmm. What did we learn? What did we do that worked? That's the question we use. What did we do that worked? Second question, what did we do that didn't work? And then if we were to do this again, what would we do differently? And that's got to be built into the process. I remember we worked for one of the large studios here in Southern California, and I was working with the head of the studio, and I suggested to the chairman, I said, what we should be doing is after every film, we should sit down and debrief and capture lessons learned. And, and that was just antithetical to that corporate culture, because if a movie fails, they don't want to talk about it ever again.
Right. Yeah. They want to move on to what could be the next success.
There you are.
Yep. Really good example. So culture is this really key driver that is kind of the plus one, right? It takes everything you're doing and makes it that much better if you have the right culture. And in the book, you do talk about ways to transform culture to really enable design thinking more, right? Yeah. What are those stages that you talk about?
Well, we talk about four stages, and we talk about it as a process, and I think of it almost more as a flow, but it works well to talk to it as a process. So the first step or the first stage is to reveal the already existing culture. In Zen, Chad, there's a saying that there's three great mysteries in life: air to the birds, water to the fish and human nature to humankind. And we add a fourth one to that, and that is corporate culture to the people in that corporation.
Right.
So corporate culture, one of its qualities is it's transparent to the people who are a part of the corporate culture. That's just the way things work around here, is the way it occurs to them. So you've got to get culture first tangible. The way we do it is, our clients hire us to do a cultural assessment. We interview literally in a Fortune 500 company, a couple hundred people from every level, every function, every geography, and we listen keenly to what they have to say. And, we can bring back to a client, here's what your corporate culture is. And so, the first step is to really look at what are the unwritten rules for success around here? What is it that gets reward? What can get you fired? Mm-hmm. Not in theory, but in practice. And that's the critical thing. And in the chapter, we give 9 elements of corporate culture, Chad, and that's a perfect matrix or framework against which to reveal the current corporate culture. Having gotten it as palpable and as real and as three-dimensional as you can in front of you, then the executives need to unhook from that, to realize this is not the way that it is. It's just the way it has been, and it could be a lot of different ways. And to start to see that a lot of this is things from the past that still grip us, as if they're present today. You know, while we say history is in the past, no, history's here right now. You know, look at the controversy in South Carolina with the Confederate battle flag, something that happened, 150 years ago in our history. We're still dealing with that today. So history is here today. And when we worked in Ford Motor Company, they used to say Henry Ford's ghost still walks the halls, because things that he had put in place intentionally, by the way, I believe, still almost 50 years later were determining executive behavior. So right. The second stage is to unhook from that and to see that you have freedom, to look to see what are the sacred cows that need slaughtering. Most important in this is for executives to take responsibility for this is the way we've had it been, because they're the ones at the top of the ziggurat and therefore clearly the ones who have most mastered the existing culture.
Okay.
So we have, so it's like ripping the Teflon, the hooks from the fleece on Teflon. You got to separate from that culture.
Which is a challenge. So certainly
you're not, that's the, by the way, that's the, I think, a lot of psychologists would say, oh yeah, yeah. Reveal. I think the piece that's critical, part of our secret sauce, is this second step stage of unhooking.
Yep. Yep. Changing it to what you want to be.
That's okay. Right. Now, unhooking then, to use a term from the 70s, the unhooking then gives you the space to create. One creates from nothing. No place in the universe can you find any nothing. There's no nothing stores. So how do I get nothing to be able to actually create something? Well, the answer is by unhooking. Unhooking creates space, and what you can do with space is create, and what you create is a possibility. Having created a possibility, you then invent that into a corporate culture, a way of working that would be wildly successful in the future. A lot of the problem with a lot of change programs and companies is they're making changes to adapt to the marketplace today. Well, in a Fortune 500 company, no matter how fast you make those changes, it's going to take more than a year to get it fully implemented. By the time you've implemented, the market's changed again. So again, another little piece of our secret sauce is we don't work on adapting to the marketplace today. We invent the marketplace of the future. We invent the corporate culture that's going to give competitive advantage in that marketplace. And then that's what gets implemented. So that's the invention piece, stage 3. And then, as I just spoke to, stage 4 is, okay, now you got to go implement that. And that means new conversations. That means new ways of interacting. That means new ways of working. Ultimately, Chad, what that means is changing the processes in the company, changing the systems in the company, changing the structures in the company. Without implementation, frankly, none of the first three steps mean anything. So it's critical that at the beginning, when you think about making this change, that you've also thought about how you're going to implement the change.
Right. And there's efficiencies to be had through here, because like you said, a lot of the culture, it just gets established in terms of processes that we do that don't need to be done anymore. And we need to address that. And the implementing part, people wonder, you know, how do we really change culture? And it's what you shared. It's the processes tell us what culture is, right? Those things that reward tell us what culture is. Those things that we penalize tell us what culture is.
Absolutely.
And the stories that people tell, that's where you can really get a sense of culture is, you know, the stories that people share, right?
Yep.
And if anyone knows anything about Southwest Airlines culture, it's probably because of stories of these heroic efforts of their employees who did something for a customer.
Exactly right. Right.
You know, exactly right. Tons of those. Good. So we got the four stages of how one can go about transforming a culture focused on design thinking in this case, and obviously, you know, for other purposes too. Good. So I think we've done a good job of talking about how important culture is, that it's really an enabler of adopting something like design thinking and making changes in an organization.
Yeah, exactly. And again, just to go back to a point you made 10, 15 minutes ago, is it's a dance going on between the existing culture and its acceptance of design thinking, and then modifying, shifting, transforming the existing culture so that it's more accepting of design thinking. But thinking you're going to jam, and that's the term I like to use, thinking you're going to jam design thinking into a company, I think is a fool's errand.
Right. Yeah. The culture has to support it. The amazing thing about strong cultures is they're very effective at killing off anything that doesn't fit.
Yeah, you got it. Right. Exactly right.
Okay. And as listeners know, we get to this part of the interviews. I always like to ask my guests for an innovation quote that they like and to share why you chose that one too. So,
well, you know, Chad, when I looked on your website, it was very clear to me that the quotes almost all had the word either innovate or innovation in it. And I chose one that doesn't have innovate or innovation in it, but I think it's a great innovation quote.
Excellent. And it's we need to get out of that rut, so I'm glad.
All right, good. Different. This is from a book. I used to, you're a Colorado man, and I went to school in Colorado, and I used to mountain climb when I was much, much younger. And I also enjoyed reading about mountain climbing. And this is from a book called The Scottish Himalayan Expedition, which was published way back in 1951, written by a member of the expedition, W.H. Murray. And in the introduction to the book, there's this great quote that I'm going to read to you. He starts out, "Until one is committed, there is hesitancy, the chance to draw back, always ineffectiveness. Concerning all acts of initiative and creation, there is one elementary truth, the ignorance of which kills countless ideas and splendid plans. That the moment one definitely commits oneself, then providence moves too. All sorts of things occur to help one that would never otherwise have occurred. A whole stream of events issues from the decision, raising in one's favor all manner of unforeseen incidents and meetings and material assistance, which no man could have dreamt would have come his way. I have learned a deep respect for one of Goethe's couplets. Whatever you can do or dream you can, begin it. Boldness has genius, power, and magic in it." So I think that is a great quote. Just reading it to you, I get goosebumps and I get inspired. And to me, it says a lot about what an innovator is up to. And that's boldness and genius.
Nathan, it's funny you said that because I was getting goosebumps as you read it, because it's a really powerful motivating statement that says, you know, when you commit, you are in, and, you know, things align and work towards your favor, and goodness happens.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, this word commitment gets bandied about, and I think diluted to some degree. The way we say it is in a breakfast of ham and eggs, the chicken supports, the pig is committed. And the analogy that I use is in diving, you know, board diving and in the Olympics and such, they say a diver's committed when he or she can't crawl back onto the board.
Right.
So it's that notion of I've said I am going to make this happen and I've given my word to it and there's no going back now. That's what I think W.H. Murray is talking about when he speaks of commitment.
Yeah, and his context of doing expeditions and Himalayans, you better be committed. That's a difficult task in front of you.
You got it.
Very good. Well, I appreciate you very much sharing the content of your chapter that you wrote for the book and about design thinking and the culture to support that. And also great nuggets in there to just think about changing culture outside of a design thinking context too. And sharing that great quote, not one I was familiar with and love the power behind that quote.
That's great.
How can people follow your work and learn more about what you do?
Well, before I say that, Chad, I want to thank you. You know, I think your website is two websites, actually. Both websites are just a gift to those of us who either consider ourselves to be designers and inventors and innovators, as well as people who actually have that as their online accountability. So first of all, thank you for the service you provide. Second of all, thank you for being generous enough to contact me and giving us at Insignium this opportunity to share the chapter with the folks that follow you. And I consider that to be an act of generosity on your part. If people do want to contact us, they can call me. My name's Nathan Rosenberg. They can call my office, which is area code 949-494-4553 in Southern California. They can also email me, although I'm way better with the phone, as you have discovered, than I am with email. But my email address is nrosenberg, N-R-O-S-E-N-B-E-R-G, at Insignium, I-N-S-I-G-N-I-A-M.com, nrosenberg@insignium.com. So either of those ways would work great.
Very good. And website
like you,
itself.
I'm LinkedIn, on LinkedIn too, so that works too.
Okay. Yep, absolutely. LinkedIn is a great way to stay connected. And the website itself for your company is?
Insignium.com. Again, I-N-S-I-G-N-I-A-M, Latin for I shall mark as extraordinary or I shall elevate.
Ah, deep meaning there.
Deep meaning, exactly.
That wasn't just any easy search out to see what URL was available. Very good. Well, Nathan, again, I appreciate your time. All the everyday innovators listening, I thank you so much for doing so. Please help other product managers make it easy to discover this podcast, share it with them. And if you listen to on iTunes, I would sure appreciate you leaving a star rating there, which is super easy. It takes you 10 seconds to go click on stars. And if you want to leave a review, all the better. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you for listening to Product Innovation Training Your Customers Will Love You For. To learn more, please check out the blog at theeverydayinnovator.com. Keep innovating.